Gary Weaver, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
Sobriety date's July 2nd, 1989. Home group is there is a solution group that meets on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock at the Holly Springs United Methodist Church. Come check us out. Good to be here this morning. We couldn't be in a worse position, this panel, after that last panel. I mean, that's just the absolute truth of the matter, and we're probably going to be a big disappointment, I mean, given the topic. But I was thinking that just a few minutes ago, if you think about it, what you heard on that first panel, that power and those miracles and that recovery couldn't take place without what we're getting ready to talk about taking place first. And if we don't, as an organization, have great cooperation with facilities and with the administration, all layers of the administration, and if we don't have good, solid AA members going into these facilities that are bringing that recovery and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, then folks like George and Dwight would never be able to come out here and talk to us. That's why it's extremely important that we as AA members take that responsibility seriously, and that we do the best that we can to really have good relationships with prison administrations, and that we're carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to develop those groups in prisons for that to happen. And we got some guys up here that have a whole lot of experience at doing that. And we've got some guys up here that like to talk about as much as George Jones likes to talk. George, you'll never live that down, buddy. You got that for a long time. Never live that down. But anyway, so that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And Rick's going to go first. And then Larry's going to come up and Tony's going to clean up. We were going to put Larry last, but we realized that we couldn't put a guy from Texas behind two guys from North Carolina, so we had to sandwich him in between two guys from North Carolina, even though he's from North Carolina. So anyway, Rick, come on up.
My name is Rick. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jerry. Well, I started out in Texas, and I got sobered in Louisiana, and now I live in North Carolina. So I was in the military. I was in the Marine Corps in my career, but I'm always amazed that they ask me to share on anything, you know, at a meeting. I'm like the behind the guy scenes, and because I do like to talk a lot, and even as a kid, I think I was like an accident waiting to happen. My sponsor would ask me, like, in the middle of something I was saying, he said, "Rick, get to the point." And so I'd been given, like, specific instructions. I got a little bit better at following directions, but that wasn't always, like, it went to a lot of changes before getting here. But I'm very grateful. My sobriety date is December 13, 1996, and I'm very grateful. I'm a member of the Made a Decision group meet aboard the St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church, aboard Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune over at Jacksonville, North Carolina. And we meet every Wednesday evening at 6:30. We're a big book study for the first three Wednesdays. The fourth Wednesday is open speaker. And if there's a fifth Wednesday, we'll study a tradition. And we did that the first time, February. And we're only 2 months old. We just got started. And that's kind of the reason, the topic that they gave me is to speak a little bit of my experience with developing structured groups and cooperation with the administration. And I wasn't cooperating a lot with anybody when I got here, but I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for a structured group. I landed in a mental ward at the Air Force Hospital in Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi. On Friday the 13th, December 1996, and that's my sobriety date. I didn't know that it was a Friday the 13th, but that's how it worked out. But I was there for 3 days, and they sent me out to Mayport Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida, and I was there for a 28-day program. And, you know, after they got us stabilized and took our vitals and everything, they started farming us out to the community to a bunch of meetings. And I'd never been to AA, never heard of AA before that. they were all discussion meetings, and it was a variety of different meetings. I'd been in the Marine Corps 18 years at the time, and I always remember they put us in this white van to go to the meetings, and one of our old-timers back in the area, he says, I remember he said one time, he says, you know, if you're ever in a white van going to an AA meeting and you ain't the driver, you might be an alcoholic. Yeah. You know, but I had no idea. We're going to a first meeting. I'm asking these guys to brief me on the ship system and all this stuff. I'm surprised they didn't pull over and tell me to get out, you know. But you know, they all were discussion meetings. But one of the things I remember is about halfway through the program there, one of the counselors was a recovered alcoholic artist. And he got at the group and he says, look, we're having our 10th month's anniversary and you know, it's a speaker meeting, it's an Eden meeting, would you guys like to go? And we all agreed. And so there was an Al-Anon and an AA speaker, and I remember the lady spoke, and I don't remember, I was so in the fog, I think I'd been sober about a week and a half. And I remember that lady spoke, and she got done, and the gentleman was a tall, slim guy, and he got up there, I remember he was real funny. And he started telling his story, and I don't remember anything he said except that he got to the jumping off place, and you know, in the middle of the laughing and the eating, and as much in the fog as I was, I remember I was sitting there, and he got to the jumping off place, and he said that he couldn't drink and he could not drink, and what he decided to do was he got a case of bottles of booze and he put it in his Corvette. I remember, for some reason, you know, 15 years, been a little over 15 years, and that's the only thing I remember to this day. But he said he put it in his Corvette and he took off down the wrong end of the street, the wrong way. And he said one of two things were going to happen. Either he was going to get killed or he was going to get stopped. And then we went on with the laughing and eating. And to this day, that's the only thing I ever remember. And I think I was hooked in the AA that night. I didn't realize it, but I think because when I got out of there, the other thing that happened, and that this was important for structured groups is because another meeting I was in, I remember I walked in the meeting and we sat down and they never, you know, we were just all sitting at a table. The guys were in a treatment center. And about halfway through the meeting, the cops came in and they arrested a guy in about the next table. And, you know, I remember sitting there. Now, it's funny, might be funny now, but I remember I was sitting there. And I remember specifically thinking, like it's today, I thought, you know, they have a lot of trouble in AA. And I'm probably going to be real helpful with my military experience, you know. And yeah, it sounds funny now, but it wasn't funny. But I share that because when I got out of treatment and I went back to Slidell, I fell into a group, the Strange Camels group, met atop the Old Town Soda Shop in Slidell, Louisiana. And I was stationed, that's where I was living. I was working down in New Orleans, commuting 29 miles each way. And I fell into the Strange Camels group. That was about the most structured group I've ever seen to this day. And there's a lot of structured groups. But they were big book oriented. They were newcomer oriented. They were principles based, traditions based. And I was there for 3 years before I left. And they had a group inventory I was a part of. I didn't know what was going on. There was a lot of screaming and arguing. And then at the end, it all settled out, you know, and everybody hugged and prayed. And then we went home. But we were there almost a better part of the day and went through all the traditions, questions. And why that was important is because, you know, because of my experience in treatment, when I landed to that group, I realized that they didn't have a sergeant at arms, and I thought that I should get that position, you know. And they didn't seem to think so. You know, I've never seen a group that had a sergeant at arms, and I'm real grateful for it now. But that was important, you know, because they caused me, incited me to fall in step with them. And otherwise, I don't know, God knows where I would have ended up, because I would have overran your position. I was always trying to, you know, I was overly opinionated and always wanted to, had ideas about stuff, but they didn't, you know, I didn't know what I was talking about, you know, and those guys, they would cut me off. They'd do it in a nice way that I didn't realize what happened until I was on my way home. Yeah. You know, they were nice about it, you know. They were just good. And then my sponsor, Chester, my first sponsor, he took me through the steps. You know, I'm one of those guys, I never knew what step I was on until I was, you know, afterwards. But I left there 3 years, and I That's the experience that I had. And I've been to three home groups in the 12 years I've been in this area. And that was that brought me to start with the help of a couple of other guys and my sponsor now, Jim F. from Kenansville, to start the Made a Decision group aboard Camp Lejeune. I think probably in those two topics, you know, really in a nutshell, is the application and living the 12-step and practicing these principles, because that's how that group came about. About 4 years ago, I had an idea about starting another group, and I went to the Catholic Church because that's the way I was raised, and that, you know, that's my faith. But over the last 4 years, they shot me down. I mean, you know, and the last time they did it, I thought it was kind of abrupt, and I got a resentment, you know, and I left the church that morning. By the time I got in my truck, I was leaving the state and packing up, and the whole religion from the Pope on down and stuff, and I mean, I was done, you know. I've been lied to and stuff, and but I tell you, thank God for the program, and by the time I got to my house, I concluded that, you know, God wouldn't have closed that door unless he needed me somewhere else. And I really, inside in my heart of hearts, I believe that. And the next morning, I was sitting at work, and about 9 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call. And it was a Navy chaplain from one of the regiments in aboard the base. And he just went off on the phone. He just said, it was like a 911 call. He said, we've got trouble out here. We've had four DUIs, and I think that's the tip of the iceberg, and the command is just checking the box. And he went on and on and on. And I just listened to him, and he said, you know, they gave me your number, and I was hoping that you would help me start a meeting out here on base. And he ended by telling me, I've already been approved use of the Catholic Church here aboard base. I didn't know what to say other than I told him, I said, well, Jim, this might be a blessing in disguise. I think this is a, and he agreed, you know, I don't know if he said he wasn't an alcoholic, but he used to drink a lot before, and he was a counselor. But I know he was cunning and baffling, because when I went, because he thinks like me, you know, but I went down there to meet him at the church, and the priest pulled up. And when the priest asked me, who are you, you know, and I told him why I was there, and he didn't know nothing about it. But, you know, but because I was already there, you know, he said, well, that's great. He said, we'd love to have you here, and we've been there ever since for the last 2 months. But we had 20 people in attendance the week before, and then this past Wednesday, there was only me and another member of the group and one newcomer. And man, that guy, to see that guy's excitement and stuff after the group, that just made the whole night. And to me, that comes from having a structured group. And I go over to the Duplin Correction Center in Kenansville, and I've been going there for the last 12 years, and started out over at the base, on and off at the brig, aboard the base, and that's where I started. But it wasn't always, you know, it's gone back and forth. It was pretty structured when I started going to Duplin. And, you know, I just started attending that meeting kind of like I do any other one, you know. And there was more sobriety there than some of outside. I mean, some of the guys there have been there a long time. I see them outside more than I see them in the camp. But one day it changed. And they'd have the NA meeting members, and they'd both attend different meeting, the groups. And they started having elections. And they started electing some of the NA members to run the AA meetings. And, you know, and I'm sitting there, and I knew absolutely, and from the way I was brought up, that that's not the way it's done, you know. And so I raised my hand and told them about it, and they stopped and they changed it, you know. And I told them what I learned in places like here while I learned to come here. And I said, you know, AA members run AA meetings, you know. And I always go back to that time I was in treatment when that gentleman talked about the jumping off place. That one drunk cheering with the other is the absolute basic foundation of the program. And everything that else that we do is for that. And I hope and pray to God that I never forget that, because that's why I'm here. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that, you know. Because after getting to my home group in Slidell, many nights when I left there, they met on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. This is how smart I was. I mean, I thought I was really smart, but they met on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and that's the only time I went to the meetings. I didn't go on Tuesdays and Thursdays because somewhere else I thought they were going to think I was disloyal and kicked me out of the group or something. I don't know. But I never checked that out with anybody, but I believe that, you know. And but I stayed there. But I'm a firm believer that you don't need 90 a night. That you, if you have a desire to stay sober, a strong, serious desire to stay sober, you can recover. And I became willing, and I was that guy, you know. But, I've always had, like, my own idea about doing things. And but thank God for sponsorship, you know. But the way that that group came about is that I send out an email and I talk to my sponsor. And I send out an email to people I think a lot of, and some are in this room. And I got some good feedback back. And, you know, I would meditate on it. And I would progress forward and be allowed myself to be led by the Spirit and that whole thing. And that's the result of that. And it's a strong foundation-based group. And I'm very grateful for it because that's what I need. I need people to hold me accountable, and I need to be accountable to the group. And in order to carry the message, you know, and the same message that I was given here, not my own twist or nothing like that, but it's big book oriented. Some of the things that have happened, and the cooperation with the administration, you know, I think that a lot of it has to do with, I go back to practicing the principles and living this program. You know, I've had some different experiences. In the beginning, when I started going to Duplin, there would be a few times when I'd get down there to the camp, and whoever the sergeant or whoever was in charge, the guard, would say, you know, there's not going to be a meeting tonight. Man, I just drove 45, 50 miles to get here. And part of me, I would just suck it up, and it was important that I don't create any conflict or having a, you know, roll out in the parking lot with this guy or tell him, yes, there is, you know. because that, my ego still is like any kind of situation that happens, my initial, the first thing that reacts is my ego. Still today, my ego, boom, already, it right away has an answer. But thank God that the thing that's going on today in my life is that there's an equal entity, and that's my spirit, and Alcoholics Anonymous and the spiritual principles that I've learned in this program, that right away jumps forward and said, calm down, you know, you don't even have a gun or a badge, what are you going to do, a citizen's arrest, or what, you know, just get to the meeting and relax, you know, take it easy, and I just go on. I don't have to do no U-turns in the highway or nothing like that. But I always learn with stories, you know, that you know, going to the speaker meetings, and I love speaker meetings, you know, and listening to the analogies and the stories, and but some of them I learned a lot of how I am. excuse me. Wayne said a long time ago that if you ever learn to laugh at yourself, you'll never be left unamused. And I think that that's important because, like, I was a guy that would never like to tell on myself, and I was embarrassed and had, you know, just thought I was the only one or unique or whatever, but I'm not, and I absolutely know that. But I'm like the guy that that was going down the road and passed to the intersection. And, you know, now they've got the cameras and the lights, and the camera flashed, and they took a picture. Well, he looked down at the odometer, and he wasn't speeding that he thought, so he went around the block and made another pass and slowed down, you know, even more. And damn if the camera didn't flash again, you know. And so he told us, what, man, watch this. And he slowed down even more and went around the block and came around. And it flashed again. And, well, about this time he gave up and went home. A week later he got 3 tickets in the mail for no seatbelt. You know? Yeah. <That's it. clears throat> But, you know, but I mean, that's the kind of like attitude. And it's good to, you know, I mean, I'm glad that we laughed today because I wasn't doing a lot of laughing when I came in. But, you know, like, no, going out into Duplin, you know, from those days back then when I thought I was on my own and I just sucked it up and went in there, and if the guy said there's no meeting, I'd leave and, you know, not come back. And, you know, it would bother me, but I would get over it. And, you know, I talked to my sponsor about it and stuff. And, but then I started coming over here and start learning about having meetings with the administrator, going and meeting with the superintendent. And, you know, things came from that. I was able to go in there back into Duplin and give, you know, put, like, workshops together, you know, 12-step work, big book studies, and sit there and go over, like, a 10-week period. And I've done them now. I've done, I don't know, maybe a dozen now over the years. But to do a big book study over a 10-week period and sit there for 2 hours on a Friday where Normally, that group meets on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and never had any problem at all, you know. And they had different relationships with the staff there, you know, that no matter who was at the guardhouse, man, those guys were just good to see. Hey, you know, how you doing? And one guy ran up to me and said, hey, I quit smoking 3 weeks ago. I said, man, that's great. You know, and just be related, you know, and be a good neighbor. Practice these principles in all our affairs, you know. And I try to do that, you know. And I really appreciate the panel this morning, too, because that is a reason. If it wasn't for this, I wouldn't be able to go back and give back. You know, I always hear the guy that says, you know, when I go back home, they know not to drink around me, and I go, man, I'd like to not be around you, period. you know. Yeah. I didn't mean that. but, you know, the way I look at it is that they saw the worst in me. Those, you know, my family got to see the absolute worst of me, and I have an absolute responsibility to show them the best of me. And I went from, you know, my oldest sister absolutely did not believe that AA or Al-Anon worked. And today, boy, she knows it works. At least she absolutely knows AA works. And she'll be telling people, I've overheard conversations about, look at Richard, man. You know, and I get embarrassed, you know, I'll leave and stuff. But she, you know, but she really believes that the program. But not because of anything I said, because I've always wanted to say stuff, but because of how we act and how we live, you know, and practicing the principles. And I think that that's more important than anything. You know, we've been able to go to the prison there and the base break, but they wouldn't allow us for a long time, and they still don't allow us in the jail in Jacksonville. And there's a guy down there that just keeps getting elected over and over again, and I guess we're never going to get in there until he leaves. But, you know, a lot of people have told me over the years that people have tried, and the guy says, absolutely not. The only thing that gets in there is a Bible and no AA, bottom line, no AA. And so people have tried. I haven't tried. And when I'm standing here telling you, that's what they've told me. And I've never tried myself. Maybe I will. But the hope that I get is that, you know, like my sponsor, Jim, today, he called me last week. I think it was Wednesday. And him and Abby are alternate DCM for the district, go too. They went down and met with the sheriff at Duplin County Jail. And because Abby was wanting to take a meeting in there to the ladies in jail. And Jim said that the sheriff stopped him about not even a minute into the conversation. He said, I don't need to hear anymore. You're in. And the guy gave him the green light. And Jim called to let me know that and to say that he also suggested, he said, well, if we're successful in this, how about if we'd like to come back and bring a meeting in to the men in the jail? And the sheriff said, man, I think that'd be great, you know. And then he said, because we've talked about our situation in Jacksonville, he said, well, you know, he said, what I'm thinking is those guys talk to each other. And I'd be surprised if maybe that guy can put some ideas into that sheriff down in Jacksonville. And that gave me a lot of hope right there. I said, man, you know, if I just kind of practice these principles and just keep doing what I'm doing, that God has an amazing way of making this whole thing work, you know. And I just need to do the footwork and to keep pressing forward and stuff. And that's what I've learned to do. And I've had, like, some really amazing stuff happen over the years. You know, one of the first workshops that I put in Duplin, you know, the first one I did with the Joe and Charlie tapes, because I figured I'd play a tape, I'd let him do my job for me. You know, I just sit there, and then we'd have a discussion the following hour. And that was pretty cool. And, I mean, I always loved Joe and Charlie. But I looked at that, and the whole thing about, like, the 10 steps says about being effective and understanding. And, you know, I'd go back and just through my travels and go into workshops and corrections rallies and things like that, and I said, well, you know, man, I've been through the steps, you know, and I'm recovered, and, you know, I have a sponsor, and I sponsor guys, and, you know, I'm just going to do it from the big book. And I took Patrick, you know, Patrick, some of you know Patrick, in a wheelchair, and he'd been going every Tuesday with me to the prison. So we went out there, same thing on a Friday, picked like 10 weeks, and we started going. We got to the third step, and, you know, all of a sudden it hit me. You know, we were getting ready to end the third step, and I said, man, you know, man, how am I going to, you know, how am I going to get all these inmates, tell them, hey, let's all get down on our knees and hold hands and pray, you know. And it just got in my head a little bit of fear, just normal. I mean, the fear is still there. But see, I remember when I took my four step with Chester back in at his home back in Slidell. And I remember I walked in there. I was about 40 years old by the time, 40, 40 and a half. And I walked in his house, and Chester was a retired Ford Motor Company worker from Kentucky. And he'd wore coveralls and a plaid shirt. Me and him had nothing in common other than I absolutely wanted what he had. I mean, this guy had the love of God in his eyes, and he lived the program, and he sponsored, and he lived the program. And he was sponsored. And he was 72 years old, had 10, 11 years sober. And I walked in his home, and he met me at the door, and I walked over to his kitchen. He said, "You got your inventory?" And I didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. I've never done a fifth step, and, you know, I'm just fearful. And I just reached out and handed it to him. And he grabbed the inventory out of my hand, and with his other hand, he grabbed my wrist, and he put his hand on the table, and he went down on his knees. And I didn't know to do anything but to follow him. And we did the third step prayer that way. And if he'd asked me, I don't know if I'd have done it, but that's the way we did it. And I remember that, sitting in that prison that day, and I something calm came over me, something deep inside overcame my fear. And I just spoke out, and I told him, I said, "We're about to do the third step prayer." And I said, "The only way I know to do it is the way I did it with my sponsor. And I'd be honored if we'd all get on our knees and say the third prayer together." And man, there was about 18 men in that room, and they all got down except one guy had a knee problem, was half on a chair and half on the floor. And we held hands and did the third step prayer. Let me tell you something, when I left that prison, when I left that unit, me and Patrick, we looked at each other, and neither one of us could speak. Man, I was just full of the Spirit. Now, we got in the truck and went down the road about 10 minutes. We'd look at each other, and I couldn't talk. You know, something very, very powerful happened in that room. And that's the thing, you know. And you know, now going back to the cooperating with the unit, you know, we try to continue that and in a lot of different ways. Like sometimes things change. The program staff has changed. And there was a guy that was there, Mr. Shepherd. I tried to stop his retirement, but I wasn't successful. You know, this guy, you know, we had such a good relationship. And but he left. And two ladies took over, and they got, you know, bumped up the chain. And so they had to learn their job, you know. But I'm trying to put a certification because we went from having one every month to having one every quarter, now one every year. And it's been over a year and a half, and they hadn't had one. And we're getting down to the, you know, people leave and people change. And I'm there, and we're like have down to about two, three people. And got my two-minute warning. But we're down to two people, and so, you know, I asked them if we could have a certification, and their response was, you know, to push it back. And I'd ask them again, and they'd push it back more, so I stopped asking. Went and talked to my sponsor, and, you know, I'm thinking in my head, first I said, well, we're going to have a meeting. It's time to have another meeting with the superintendent and so forth. And but I didn't. I waited. And, you know, all I had to do was just pray a little bit and let them, you know, that everything's. And the following morning, I got an email from that lady. And she said, you know, I'm sorry we took so long, and but we've set the date for 28 March to do that certification. And I've got two guys already applications in there, and they're ready to go. And that's a Duplin correction. Dean called me a while back and asked me to be the coordinator for Region 10 and kind of oversee like five prisons where it's attended by a lot of people. Carteret wasn't attended. We just now got like five people certified in there. And we got a regular meeting on a Friday evening at 8 o'clock, and they've got different formats, and brought their poster in there for the first time, and pretty grateful for that. But so it's been a ride, but it's been an experience for me. But just for me to be able to go back and do that, I mean, that's the juice for me today. I mean, I've get more out of that than anything else I do in AA, you know. And for that, I'm really grateful, and I appreciate you asking me to come up here, and I appreciate you guys listening and letting me share. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Is this your watch or is it George's watch? Whose watch is this? Oh, it's your watch.
You put that up there so you don't take all this time.
Oh. Larry Johnson, an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is the 18th of September, 1972, and I'm thankful for that. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I could give you a litany of reasons, but I think the primary reason is because of God's grace. And that put me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous right away. Thank you, Rick. And just before I get into I hope I can stay with these notes. I got this pretty good stuff right here if I don't wander off. But Rick and I were, well, mostly Rick. I want to tell you about how Alcoholics Anonymous is not a small organization. This is huge. There's a friend of mine in Fort Worth whose son and daughter live, I think, in Tennessee, and their son was in the Marine Corps down at Camp Lejeune and was in jail in one of those surrounding counties down there with a problem. And he obviously had a problem with alcohol and maybe drugs. I call Steve M. in Raleigh. He gives me Rick's number in Jacksonville, and we get the contact made with this guy. I mean, and it took probably less than 30 minutes to get all that coordinated. And we're an organization without organization. So I don't know how we do that. It's a pretty well-organized deal that we had going there. When Jerry asked me before I came up to the dais if I had had my instructions yet, and I told him not yet. He said, well, just tell your story. And I said, there's no way there's going to be enough time for that, I guarantee you. I'm serious, it'd take a long time. What I want to address is on the handout, the brochure, we talk about working with the administration. And I'd like to talk about working with the administration of prisons. And one of the things that I started doing this, I've been going in and out of jails and prisons ever since I've been sober. My first time behind a locked door, I was 6 months sober, and we were doing meetings in the drunk tank at the Dallas County Jail. So I got the bug pretty quick. And then later, I was able to go with a guy to a federal prison in Siegelville, Texas, which is just down the road from the city of Dallas. And then the next time I went behind locked doors, I had to go down and pay my dues to the Dallas County Sheriff. And I stayed down there, I think either 3 or 4 days, and got that behind me. So I haven't had to be in jail since then. The others I didn't have to go. That one I had to go. Doesn't make any difference how sober you are. If you owe the judge or the sheriff, you got to go pay him. And if you don't, they'll come get you. And that was my case. What I have learned, the most important thing in setting up and opening the door to a prison for Alcoholics Anonymous is somebody has got to initiate a meeting. I don't believe that texting and emails will get this done. I know from experience that if I can get eyeball to eyeball with the head of a prison and get him to listen for a few minutes, that we can get something done. My first experience with this, I got to tell you, I was a little bit nervous. We opened the doors to a maximum security penitentiary in East Texas. I've talked about this a little bit last night, called the Cofield Unit, a tough unit, real old-fashioned prison. Got four stories to it. And they were having a meeting a month, if they were lucky. And all it was a meeting. There was no group there. And what we did and how we initiated this meeting, and the way we've initiated meetings since then when they needed to be initiated, is we call the office down in Huntsville, which is the center of the Texas prison system. And there's someone there who coordinates this kind of stuff. And so we call down and we talk to Leanne. I think Tom probably knew Leanne. But we talked to this gal named Leanne, and she set up a meeting with Warden Moore at the Cofield unit. And me and my road partner went down there. And I knew what I was going to say when I got there. You know, I made sure that I was prepared for this meeting. And we met with the warden, Warden Moore, who was the head warden and an assistant warden. And when we went into his office, you could see that there was a little bit of reluctance on his part to hear us. But somebody had sent word to him, meet with these guys. And so he was following somebody's instructions, because I could tell the warden was a little reluctant. And he said, what do you guys want? And I said, we just want a few minutes of your time. And I explained to him what we wanted to do in that prison. I said, what we want to do here is start an AA group in your prison. I understand there used to be a group here, but we want to start an AA group here in your prison. And we're not, at any time as our comings and goings here, are we going to tell you how to run your prison. And we'd also would be reluctant to get any advice from you on how to run the AA meeting and the AA group. Not exactly in those words, but that was kind of the context of it. And he listened. And I think the real selling point that day with this guy was that I said, what will happen here? And as he asked me, he said, well, what will happen? How will that affect what we do? I said, in the beginning, you probably won't notice much. But when we get this group started and these men who are coming to this meeting come to understand that this is their home group and they take ownership of this group, you're going to find there will be little pockets throughout your prison where you'll see changed attitudes, and that'll have effect on others, and you'll see that. And but if you give us time to do that, I believe this is what you're going to see. So we won his confidence that day. In a couple of Saturdays after that, we started the meeting there. And what we have to do is we've got to follow through on what we say we'll do. Now, I'm a pretty good salesman, and I pitched this guy pretty good. And he bought the package that I brought. But we had to follow up on that. And the only time they would allow us to meet, and it's due to the logistics of the prison, this is a huge prison, there's 3,800 inmates in there. And it was 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. Actually, he said, prefer you be here at 7:45. As a matter of fact, he said, I'd really like for you guys to walk through our gate at 7:30 on Saturday morning. Now, I'm not trying to top Rick's story, but it's 100 miles. From my house to the gates of that particular prison. And some of the guys who live further up in the north side of Dallas, it's even further. But that doesn't matter. And so we told the guy, we'll have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get down here. And he said, I'm sorry, that's the only time I can let you in. I never worked so hard to get in a jail in my life as I did in that one. And we are there every Saturday morning to this day. There were two guys that walked through the gate of that prison this morning at 7:30 a.m. to help start a group meeting in that prison. I had the privilege of formulating or helping them form a structure in their group. That's a structured AA group. They have a GSR, they have a secretary, they have a literature guy. They alternate being the meeting chairs. And we go. And I'll tell you this quick little story. This was in the summer, about 7-8 years ago now, I think. And Saturday fell on Christmas Day, fell on Saturday that year. And it was a winter morning in Texas. And we have winter mornings in Texas sometimes in December, and sometimes we have spring mornings in Texas in December. But this was a wintry morning. And it was sleeting. It was about 30 degrees outside. And in order for these guys to get into the meeting, they have to have a lay-in pass. And without the lay-in, they can't get in the door to go into the schoolhouse for the meeting. And they were asking for their lay-ins. And the guards were telling them, it's Christmas Day. The weather is horrible outside. The roads are real questionable. There's nobody coming from Dallas, Texas today to do an AA meeting. And these guys said, they'll be here. They will be here. They've not missed since they started. They will be here. And they finally convinced the guards to give them, or the captain or whoever it was, to get the lay-ins to them. And at 7:30 that Christmas morning, two men from Alcoholics Anonymous walked through the gates of that prison. I believe that that's the kind of commitment we have to hold to when we tell these prison officials that we're going to do something. That it's not that Larry Johnson is going to do this. Alcoholics Anonymous is going to hold to their word, and you'll see that from us. And we won the confidence of not just the warden and the assistant warden, but the guys at the gate, the guys in the picket, the central control desk. Bill McGee and I, I've used his last name, but this is AA, we're in the side of the AA meeting here. But anyhow, Bill McGee and I walked in there one Saturday morning with two shopping bags full of big books. He had a bag and I had a bag. And because of our keeping true to our word and not ever causing anybody any trouble, they never asked us what was in the bags. They never did. We got all the way to the schoolhouse. I said, Bill, did anybody ask you what was in your bag? And he said, no, not a soul. And I think the only way you can win that kind of trust is doing what you say you do when you say you're going to do it. And as a result of that, we were just a few months into that unit, and we got a call from a warden just up the road. That warden didn't call me or didn't call Bill, but he called the lady in Huntsville. And he said, I've heard about this group over at Cofield. We'd like for those guys to start one here. And we went down and met with that warden. And that's the only guy that I'll talk to, is the warden. I won't talk to the warden. I've upset a couple of chaplains, and I appreciate what chaplains do. I actually hold papers myself that I could be one myself. But that's a whole other story. I have a couple of them that got a little bent out of shape that we went around him because he runs all that, and we're not trying to... I'll go over anybody's head. We just want to go to the guy that runs the show. And that's been my experience. If you get the warden on board with you, they're going to hold meetings. And there's going to be AA meetings there. And I'll tell you one quick story about why I will only talk to a warden. I didn't get conned in. I agreed to go and talk to a major and a chaplain about setting up an AA group in a maximum security prison. And they gave us a time. And we were there on time. Nobody knew we were coming. And they took us into the chapel, and there was a guy in the chapel preaching to about 300 guys. And I told Bill, I said, this ain't where we belong. So we went and found the chaplain, couldn't find that major. And he said, he put us, and this will never happen again, he put us in the head. I mean, really, it was a large head. I mean, it was huge. And they had a partition up between the benches and the utilities there and expected us to hold an AA meeting in there. And I said, this will never happen again. And I went and talked to one of the sergeants or whatever he was. I think it was a sergeant. And I said, this just won't do. We're Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not a second-rate group of folks. But we have a message to carry, and we want proper facilities to carry it in. And we just can't do this. There's never been, we had trouble in that prison from the word go. Because we didn't go to the guy that run the prison and get him on board with us. So we got to set those meetings up. And that today, that's a BDO unit. There's no meeting there. We never could get the warden to come on board with us. We're still working on him. And they'll change wardens over time. They do a lot of changing in Texas and wardens. And as soon as I've got a guy that I correspond with down there, and he'll let me know when there's been a change. When there's been a change in administration, we'll make another run at them because this is a huge unit. And we were having some really good, strong AA meetings in that group down there. And I've had the honor, to me it's an honor and truly a privilege to be able to initiate anything. And with the teamwork that we have put together, and we don't have any really formal training in this. We just worked through our own experiences. And we held meetings, our own meetings, and to coordinate how we were going to do things. Unlike some folks, there's nobody that tells us how to do this. The Northeast Texas area, the service area of Alcoholics Anonymous in Northeast Texas, don't write the guidelines for us. We follow the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We hold true to AA tradition, and we will not, under any circumstances, compromise the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous just to get a meeting going or to get a group going. Because we want it to be a solid AA group, and the results of this work that's been done by some 40 or 50 men, there's guys running around Texas, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, not unlike the stories we've heard here so far this weekend, the same stories. There's one guy in particular that I remember telling him, when you hit the ground, you make a call. And I gave him my number, and at 5:30 one Friday afternoon, I got a call. He said, Larry, this is John. You said when I got out and I hit the ground to call you, I'm calling. I'm at the Greyhound bus station, and he lived in Seymour, Texas, which is out west of us. He said, my next bus doesn't leave until 11:30 to go home. Is there any chance you're going to a meeting tonight? And I said, there's a real good chance that I'm going to a meeting tonight. And I'll be down. I went down and picked him up, and he went to the meeting with me, and he got him a Free World Desire chip. We give him paper chips in there. They can't have metal. And he took him a chip. I thought, John didn't get drunk. Well, I know he didn't because I've been with him. But he said, I just wanted one of those Free World chips. And then we took John out to dinner. The group, all they went out to eat. And we went to the Red Robin hamburger joint. And John put on a show for us. That was the first Free World hamburger. He'd been there 10 years. And he hadn't seen a hamburger like that. And he's not sure the hamburgers he got were hamburgers. And we all stopped eating and watched John enjoy his hamburger. And I put him on that bus to Seymour, and for 2 or 3 years he'd call me every Sunday night until he finally got himself situated up there. walked into the volunteers meeting at the International Convention in San Antonio. I got fortunate enough to be the Northeast Texas volunteer coordinator for volunteers from up in my area. And I walked into the first meeting, and there sat another guy that had been in that group. And he was a volunteer at the International Convention in San Antonio, and you probably run across him. He probably greeted you at one of the meetings while you were there. And this is powerful stuff that we got going here. And I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you, Larry. Good job. Thank you. Tony Dotson, alcoholic. It's good to be here. Good to be sober. Sobriety date's June the 13th, 1987. My home group is the Willow Springs 12-Step Group, which meets in Fuquay, Varina, North Carolina. And we meet on Sundays and Thursdays. I'm also the outside sponsor for the Triangle Group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets inside Central Prison, a maximum security facility in Raleigh. I also have had the honor and privilege to be Regional 5 coordinator, which means I'm Dean's helper, and I've enjoyed that, and hopefully to be able to talk about some of the things that I've been able to do, and certainly those are in the guidelines of what we're talking about here. Building the relationships with staff, and I've been going into correctional facilities now for 11 years, going on 12 years, and I've been coming to this conference for the same amount of time. There's no coincidence in that other than the fact that this is about the time I started doing this type of work. The man that sponsors me was heavily involved in this type of work, and I was sponsored into carrying the message behind the walls. We began our journey at Central Prison 11 years ago. They were just about to shut down the meeting that was happening in this facility. And there was about 18 to 23 of us in there. I can't get the exact count, but there was quite a few people showed up that night for the meeting with the staff at the facility. We all went through the orientation, filled out applications. There was a lot of people there that night. I was impressed by that. And we went in, and about 2 weeks later, it was just Jerry and I. And I don't know what happened to that big crowd we had, but it distilled down real quick. But in a way, I'm kind of glad of that because I got to see firsthand how you establish the relationships that are so necessary to carry that message in there. I watched as these things developed, as Miss Branch come to know us, come to trust us, and become an advocate for us. And she made sure that not only did we have a place to meet, as we learned, we started out and we made some adjustments. We started out with a really large crowd. We brought up Unit 2, which is a transitional unit, and we combined it with the large unit upstairs in WRB. And we realized that it just was too much. It was just too large a group to manage and to effectively carry that primary purpose. And so I watched the decisions being made. We divided it back up. We got it to something that was more manageable. And we began to get in there one-on-one and began to work with these guys. And the first thing we did was lay out a format for that group so that when they had a meeting, they knew what we were meeting about. We had set up those formats similar to our home group, was that we'd have a certain Monday every month that we would look at the tradition corresponding with that month. The following, we would be in a chapter of the Big Book, or we would be on a 12-step, or we'd be talking about AA history or something like that out of the literature. And then on the Wednesday night meeting, we started to play with different formats. We knew we wanted a speaker meeting. We wanted some other things. And as this woman began to watch this process take place, her confidence grew in us and our ability to effectively do this. And I'm kind of watching Jerry, and I'm watching what's going on, and I'm learning through this wonderful experience to just kind of sit back and watch it all happen, you know. And as things happened, it wasn't long. Jerry was he moved to Ohio, and I looked around. It's just me, and that happens to a lot of us in here. I hear that from this podium a lot, and thank goodness I had that good sponsorship and I had that leadership, and that's what I was thinking when Larry was up here talking about. Was that's the kind of leadership that we need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the kind of leadership that opens those doors that are generally closed. Those are the things that when we get in there with integrity and we say what we mean and we mean what we say, and we follow that up with those commitments and we honor those commitments, those people see one day at a time that we're for real. And then we began to have opportunities. I was meeting with these guys and taking them through the steps, and we were having to do it during the meeting. So when I got to a point to where I wanted to take a guy over to do a fifth step, they gave me a room, let me have a room, let me have access to this guy, and we go in and we're doing this. And both of us, I think, you know, it'd really be nice to be able to do this some other time than have to miss the meeting to do this, but we'll do whatever we need to do. And over time, as staff changed, got promotions, people came, they came, go, we had exposure to Ms. Judge, Ms. Branch, Ms. Bellinati. I mean, it's just the names went on and on. And I was amazed at the turnover they have in TOC. They come in and out. But what we did each time, we had to redevelop that trust. We had to redevelop that relationship. And the gentleman that's our programs guy now, he has been absolutely a blessing. And he's in Alcoholics Anonymous corner four square, and I say that with this commitment is that this guy went in. I told him what I needed. I would like to have an hour before the meeting so that we could do some sponsoring of these guys. We could go in there, get this done, and not have to miss the meeting. And he wanted to know. He's kind of watching these men that were working these steps, and their personalities began to change, their lives began to transform. And he could see firsthand that we weren't just telling you what we're doing. There he said, giving them the sales pitch. He was seeing firsthand that these guys weren't causing problems in the chow line. They weren't causing problems on their jobs. They weren't getting in fights with other inmates. They weren't having the things that was happening with those. Their lives were being transformed as a direct result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what he allowed us to do was he went to the warden, asked him if we could have an hour. He said, I'm here anyway. I'm going to be here from 12 o'clock to 9 o'clock. All they're asking is an hour and a room. Can we do it? He came back. He says, you got your hour. So we started doing that. And then, you know, I watched what was happening in these men's lives as they're going through these steps and they're writing these amends letters and he's seeing these things go in and out. And I watched this whole group begin to develop. And like you're talking about was you would see men that were jockeying to chair the meeting. That was a big deal. They wanted to chair that meeting. They wanted to be, because when we first got in there, it was a cash camp. So we had a treasurer. And he would collect the money, and then it had to go in an envelope and go to staff and that type of thing. But that quickly changed, and we were wondering how to do that. And this steering committee, if you would, for these men in there in this group, in the Triangle group, these guys came up with their own way that since it was a non-cash camp and they had accounts at the canteen, these guys came up with the idea to use their accounts, swipe the card, make a donation to AA. They went to staff, talked to them about it. Program said, great idea. We have no problem with that. They purchase their own coffee. They purchase as much of their supplies as they can with the minimal amount of income that they have in working in that facility. But they come up with this on their own, and I watched that group conscience develop, and I saw that group grow through the leadership that I was allowed to be able to be a part of and watch that happen. And that's what, to me, we couldn't have done that. If we didn't have the relationships with the staff, that would have never happened. I just couldn't have happened. But it was that showing up week in and week out and making that commitment and working with these men no matter what happened. And there was sometimes there would be disruptions in the meeting. And that's when the staff, hey, they'll escort them out. You know, this we're not going to have this in here. You know, this is too important. What these men are doing in here, these men's lives are changing. We're not going to have you come in here and monkeying around. If you want to come in here and sit down and be quiet and observe and listen and be a part of, that's fine. But if you come in here to jerk and jive, you got to go. And we don't even have to do that. I mean, you used to. We had to kind of work that on our own, and now they just handle that for us. They make that possible. One of the things that in that primary purpose we talk about and how important sponsorship is that the men that I've had the privilege to sponsor through those steps, they've had custody changes and they've moved on. And when they move on, it's important for me, and I ask them, I said, when you know, because sometimes you don't know when you're going to ship, it's the middle of the night, they tap them out and they go. I said, if you know where you're going to go, let me know. More than likely, I know who's going to be there, where the meeting is, who you need to get in touch with, so when you get there, you get right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous once you land there. And we started doing that, and that has worked out real well for us. We've got a lot of guys that scattered now as a result of that. And that's what's supposed to happen. I think that transition should be a natural part of that group. If it's a healthy group and those 12 steps are working in those men's lives, then you should have that transition. And I'm grateful to be a part of that. I got a letter the other day from a gentleman that I sponsored, and we never know what seeds we're going to plant. And this guy was a, boy, he was a real tough customer. He didn't want to get on those knees and do that third step prayer. And I had about 12 guys, and there was a couple of guys outside, Tim R. and a couple of others that were in there with us. And they didn't know how we were going to handle that. And I'm going to do it the same way we always done it. You know, we're reading through the book. We get to that point where we get on our knees, and I just slid the chair back, dropped down on my knees, and watch that circle form, and they just fell right in with me. I didn't have to say a word, and we said that prayer, and when we got up, we went right at that, writing that that inventory for the resentment list, and just went right after it. We just didn't pause or anything. We said that prayer, we got up, and did just like my sponsor did me, and we got right on it, and we went right on through it. And I'll just never forget that transformation that I saw in that room. Was there was a sense of belonging that they had now. They belonged to that group. That's their group. They watched what was happening in there right before their eyes. It was real. It was genuine. It wasn't something somebody was telling them. And what we go through with the cooperation with the administration is that one of the things that I've seen is they have a volunteers banquet each year, and they invite us to go to the volunteer. And I try to go. That's an honor. That's something that we should do. But we've had a lot of times trouble trying to turn down Volunteer of the Year awards. They want to give us those, and we're like, well, thank you, but we can't accept that. So you can give it to the church guys that come in. We're not going to be able to do that. I appreciate it, but we'll have to turn it down. And I don't know how many times they've offered it to us guys, but we just always decline, and that's a great thing. The other thing that our programs guy has allowed us to do is to bring in outside guys. We have a speaker meeting now once a month, and we bring in an outside volunteer. It helps if you have an ID card. It's not a must, but it helps. And we can get you in and out real easy like that. If you don't, then it takes a DCI check, as you know, the routine, and it takes a week or so to get you on the memo to where we can get you in. But that's not a showstopper. That's just a delay. But what he does, he facilitates that. And we've been able to have a couple of workshops. And we brought the first one, we brought in Steve M. We brought him in, and he did it in two times because Steve can't do the 12 traditions in one night. So we broke it up for him, and we got him as far as we did the first. We do it the fifth Wednesday. Every month it has a fifth Wednesday. We do that, and we brought him in one, and then we like got lucky, and every other month it was like we had another fifth Wednesday. So we brought him in to finish the job, as Paul Harvey says, the rest of the story. So he came in and finished from 8 to 12 for us and did a really good job. And then I had Jerry come in last time, and he did the history of the 12 steps, how the origin was, how Bill come about those, the history of those, as you know, from the Oxford groups, and how that developed and how it became, and he made it personal, how it transformed his life. And then these guys could identify with that, and the questions begin, and that was just and what made it possible is that we had an hour and a half to do this. Our programs guy set up extra time. He got us in early so we could get access to the guys and we could go in there and do that. And that's impossible without that kind of cooperation, without that. And the other thing I do is I invite him to our group anniversary. My home group anniversary is a wonderful thing. It's a big feed, and he comes every year. He loves it. And he's heard Tom speak. He's heard Wallace. He's heard a lot of people give their talks. And speaking of Wallace, he comes in every month and shares the experience, strength, and hope with these guys, taking us take one step a month that month, and reading and sharing, and then opening it up and calling on one of us to maybe continue that and get some of the inmates to share their experience that are actually worked through the steps with us. One other thing that helped me on that was I have an officer that works at the main gate when you come through, and he's at the car gate when you drive through. And Officer West stopped me one night, and he says, "You guys with AA, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I got a buddy of mine." Everybody's got a buddy. He said, "I got a buddy of mine." It was his barber. That would be a good thing to sober up your barber. You don't lose your tip of your ear. He's got this buddy of his that he needs to help out, and he wanted to know if we'd give him a big book. And he saw us toting them books in and out every time. And I said, absolutely, I'd be honored to. I'll get you a big book. Gave him a big book, gave him my name, and a few weeks later he called me. He said, we got him. He said, I gave him your number. He's going to call you. Can you get him to a meeting? So we got the guy, rounded him up, got him to a meeting. And I get an update every now and then from Officer West, whether he's doing well or he's doing good or he's doing bad. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. We're there when he's ready. We're not going to go rope and lasso you down, but we're there when you're ready to come. But I think that would be absolutely impossible if he didn't see us coming and going every week and knowing that transformation is taking place. Let me see. Building the relationships for me inside with the group, those men had to come to trust me. They don't think they trusted me right away. I don't think they knew if I was for real or not. But when you spend time one-on-one with a man and you go through that big book the way that we do, and they begin to hear you sharing your experience, strength, and hope with working those steps, and you open up and you share what your life, what you were like, what happened, and what your life's like today. As you go through that in that third step and you share with them what transformed your life, and my third step was one of those things that the book talks about, that sometimes a very great effect was felt. And I shared that with those guys, that I went to my sponsor's house. The only thing I wanted to do was to stop hurting, and I didn't want to drink that day. And I ended up on my knees taking a third step prayer. And when I left his house that day, that overwhelming obsession and compulsion that just moments before was paramount was absolutely removed and never come back since that day. And I shared that with these men. And I talked about the things that we did in that fourth step, going through that resentment and how those things just poisoned my life, and how those self-centered fears, not relying on God but relying on me, that juggernaut of self-will had beat me into that state of reasonableness. And how that my conduct over the years past, the people that I had harmed, like Dwight and George were talking about, how we harmed the family, the folks close to us, and how I went through that, and how those steps and those questions and that sponsorship allowed me to work through that stuff so that I didn't have to live that way anymore. And then we went right after 6 and 7. And do you really mean it? If you really mean it, then we went after 8 and 9. And they wrote those letters, and they invited people in that were willing to come make face-to-face amends. They were there and willing to do that. The thing I'm going to close with is that my sobriety, and it would not be today what it is if it were not for the experiences that I've had doing corrections work. It has absolutely solidified my sobriety. It brought me to a closer understanding of what God's will was for my life and for what God's will is for the lives that are about me today. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Great job. Hopefully you got something out of that you can take back with you to help you improve whatever it is you're doing out there. I know that we're standing in the way, we're in front of lunch, so I don't think anything needs to be added to what these guys said. Just know that what they were talking about and that work is important. I mean, we need to take it serious in terms of building those relationships with the administration and making sure we're doing our part to make sure there's a good, solid group in these prisons. So we will break for lunch, and we're back here at 1:00.